You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting lightly.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive.
An interactive library of high quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on,
let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all
Race.
On this edition of Let's Talk About Race, we are diverting from our regular programming to celebrate the May 19th birthdays of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama. On paper, Yuri Kochiyama and Malcolm X made an unexpected pair. A Japanese-American mother of 6 and a Muslim minister, black nationalist, and human rights activist. Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama had a revolutionary friendship that was interrupted by Malcolm X's assassination in 1965. And at the assassination of Malcolm X, Yuri was there. May 19th is the birthday of both Yuri Kochiyama and Malcolm X. As we celebrate their birthdays, Yuri and Malcolm's revolutionary friendship highlighted the multiracial cooperation of the civil rights movement and the broader fight against racial injustice around the world. With the music of blues scholars, Grassroots News invites our listeners to celebrate the revolutionary friendship of Yuri Kochiyama and Malcolm X on their birthdays, May 19th. This is Malcolm X.
Malcolm X is an extraordinary figure for whom African Americans have this deep affinity.
Malcolm X is one of the most historic and most significant human beings in American history.
Malcolm Little was born May 19, 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. His father, Earl Little, was an outspoken Baptist minister and supporter of Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement. His push for civil rights made him the target of death threats, forcing the family to move several times. In 1929, their home in Michigan was burned to the ground, and 2 years later, Earl was found dead. This was a devastating blow for Malcolm's mother, who was eventually committed to a mental institution. Her 8 children were sent to orphanages and foster homes. In school, Malcolm was a smart and focused student until he told his teacher in high school he wanted to become a lawyer.
He wanted to be a lawyer, but they told him that they said niggers don't get to be lawyers. So that's an unreasonable goal for a nigger. And so to some extent, America created Malcolm X. So those are the forces that made him into the person that he eventually became.
He dropped out and moved to Boston. Over the next few years, he held various jobs and moved from Boston to Flint, Michigan, to Harlem and New York, and finally back to Boston. During this period, he started his street career as a pimp, drug dealer, and gambler. In 1946, he was arrested for burglary and sent to prison. In prison, he began reading everything he could get a hold of. Inspired by his brother Reginald's conversion to Islam, Malcolm read the teachings of Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. Malcolm dropped his slave name, Little, and chose X to represent his lost tribal name. By the time he was paroled in 1952, he had committed himself to the Nation of Islam. He was a very charismatic and powerful speaker who conveyed Elijah Muhammad's teaching to the masses. He was appointed national spokesman. During this time, membership increased from 500 to 30,000.
Malcolm emerged as this extraordinarily talented, itinerant minister. And he preached a creed of black superiority that blacks controlled themselves.
In 1958, Malcolm X married Betty X in Lansing, Michigan. The couple had 6 daughters, including twins Malak and Malika, born in 1965 after their father's death and named for him. Malcolm X rejected the civil rights movement's use of nonviolent protest. Instead, he encouraged black men to use any means necessary to protect themselves.
That Malcolm's clarion call for blacks to mobilize and fight against racism inspired millions of African Americans, even those who disagreed with him. They respected him as a person, as a man.
Malcolm's faith was challenged when he found out that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had seduced several women in the Nation of Islam, and some had bore his children. In 1964, Malcolm X renounced Elijah Muhammad and left the Nation of Islam. He founded a religious organization, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and took a pilgrimage to the Holy Land of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. In Mecca, he met people of all races he could call his brothers. He renamed himself El Hajj Malik al-Shabazz and returned to the U.S. with new hope for the future. He founded the Organization of Afro-American Unity to unite blacks all over the world. Malcolm was seen as a threat to the Nation of Islam, and he was informed that members were plotting to assassinate him. His home was firebombed, but he and his family were unharmed. On February 21, 1965, Malcolm started a presentation at the Audubon Ballroom in New York when 3 gunmen ran up and shot him 15 times at close range. He was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital. In his 39 years, Malcolm was constantly reinventing himself. At the end of his life, he was speaking to all races, not about civil rights, but human rights.
Malcolm's image of an uncompromising rebel who challenged and fought against racial injustice, and he was prepared to die for his beliefs.
He is a person that inspired millions of African Americans to figure out their self-worth, to elevate their self-esteem. He led people to come in and demand more from the great country in which they live.
This is Yuri Kochiyama.
It is the story of a 73-year-old Japanese-American whose life in Harlem turned her into a political activist. She was inspired by Malcolm X, and she's been fighting for human rights ever since the 60s.
So I came to Harlem at a very good time politically. It was 1960.
when everything was popping, because black people were fighting for civil rights, not only down south, but up here. And so I think when we came here to Harlem and all this was happening, it was so good for our family. I mean, we all became, educated, you know, politicalized.
The question we put to this commission is, how does the government...
It was 1960 when Yuri Kachiyama, her late husband Bill, and their six children moved into the newly built projects on 126th Street in Harlem.
We joined Harlem Parents Committee, which is not a radical group, but it's a very good civil rights organization, and they were fighting for better schools. We met all the civil rights kind of people. But then when we would go down the streets and hear street speakers, well, we got more interested in what was happening on the streets, and that would be more like Malcolm X group.
She met Malcolm in 1963 at a court hearing. She had been arrested while protesting.
Malcolm X seemed so radical, and if you remember way back then, all the media just crucified him. They tried to smash him, make him seem like such a hate monger, when all he was doing, he was just being very pro-black and fighting for his own people. I joined his organization and used to go to the Audubon to hear him speak, and also began going to his liberation school. But he came here to meet with some of the writers of the Hiroshima-Nagasaki World Peace Study Mission, because they wanted to meet Malcolm more than any other person in the United States. I think they were curious to know why the U.S. government would be so afraid of just one black leader.
After that meeting in her home, Yuri and Malcolm became good friends. She treasures the postcards he sent from his travels.
He sent about 11 of them from about 9 different countries. And this one is from Kenya. It says, "Greetings from Kenya, the home of those great African patriots, the Mau Mau freedom fighters." And then from Kuwait, he sent this one saying, "Still trying to travel and broaden my scope since I've learned what a mess can be made by narrow-minded people."
My priority would be to fight against polarization, because this whole society is so polarized. I think there are so many issues that all people of color should come together on. And there are forces in this country who want this polarization to take place.
As a woman, and specifically an Asian American woman, she is very unique. And when we talked to people when we were doing this project, time and time again, people talked about her ability to work across, I guess, what you would call cultural lines.
Pat Saunders has known Yuri for 30 years. She has documented her political activism in a film titled Yuri Kachiyama, Passion for Justice.
She and her husband, Bill, her late husband, have a history of what they would call open houses, and I don't know if she talked about this, going back to the 50s actually, but really got active in the 60s with having weekly gatherings at her house.
Bill and Yuri met during World War II when all Japanese Americans were removed from the West Coast, taken from their homes, and sent to internment camps around the country. Yuri's father died shortly after being imprisoned by the FBI.
The internment didn't politicize me, sadly. It took me a long time. I was not political until I came to Harlem, and then everything seemed to change.
In her 40 years of political activism, Yuri has marched with the Vietnam anti-war movement, picketed to get jobs for blacks, Hispanics, and Asians, demonstrated with the Young Lords, taken over public buildings with the Black Panthers. She was even arrested for the 1977 siege of the Statue of Liberty, an effort to bring attention to the Puerto Rican independence movement.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
I'm joined with my producer co-host,
Jenny Yokoyama.
We are here to discuss the revolutionary friendship between Yuri and Malcolm X, Yuri Kochiyama.
Perfect.
When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my kasamas. When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hears this, it's an honor. Because when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
here comes Yuri Kochiyama, who, you know, she kind of just started off as like a middle class person, and then she gets put in these camps, and then when she comes out, she becomes this revolutionary activist for, especially for the Japanese American community. She was seen as just being absolutely over the top extremist.
We didn't have all the rights that Caucasians had, and it was because of racism. And of course, when December 7th happened, it was also hysteria, and Americans also looked at December 7th from a very economic point of view. I mean, Japan had been working the land. I mean, she was given only the worst kind of desert land, and she made it fertile. And so other farmers, Caucasians, it would be to their advantage if the Japanese were thrown out and they could work the land. So I think on what are the civil rights we lost, I think, well, we never had all the civil rights. I think a lot of Japanese felt they weren't treated like a real American.
On December 7th, 1941, the Empire of Japan launched an attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. In the following months, hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans were rounded up and sent to internment camps under suspicion of disloyalty to the United States. But the feelings that paved the road to internment began long before the attack. For more than 80 years, Asian immigrants were viewed as economic threats, spurring various laws that effectively banned them from the country. For those who made it to America, the lingering resentment culminated after Pearl Harbor. Motivated by vocal outcries from politicians and military officials, FDR signed Executive Order 9066, empowering the U.S. Army to designate areas from which any or all persons may be excluded. He later formed the War Relocation Authority to establish 10 permanent camps, housing nearly 120,000 Japanese Americans, mostly from the Western United States. Two-thirds of those interned were native-born American citizens. With only 6 days to dispose of their possessions, residents were forced to sell their belongings and even their homes for small sums of money. Internment camps were often situated in isolated deserts, prone to harsh weather, and surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers. Within the barracks, internees lived in small one-room apartments with little privacy and constant surveillance. They were only given a standard army cot, blankets, and a small heating stove. Despite these difficult living conditions, internees tried to establish a sense of community, creating newspapers, schools, churches, and farms. Even in the face of persecution, young men came forth to join the military. Nearly 33,000 Japanese Americans served during World War II, many of whom became highly decorated for their valor in battle. Yet as the war continued, public opinion worsened against Japanese Americans. Only 35% of the country thought they should be allowed home once the war was over. This sentiment kept the camps open for over 3 years. On December 17, 1944, the government announced that Japanese American evacuees could return to their homes. When they did return, they found their homes looted and their possessions gone. With work almost impossible to come by, many fell homeless and destitute. At the time, the federal government offered no assistance for those attempting to rebuild their lives. It would take over 40 years before President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, paying reparations to each victim of internment.
No payment can make up for those lost years. So what is most important in this bill has less to do with property than with honor. For here we admit a wrong. Here we reaffirm our commitment as a nation to equal justice under the law.
Why do you think she was so attracted to Malcolm X? Because for African Americans, and full disclosure, I'm a woman of color. I'm African American and Native. You're Japanese American. We don't have many revolutionary bonds, except your people were placed in an internment camp during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, for World War II, for African Americans, it was the road out of those plantations in the South, you know, the Great Migration. And here in Harlem, these two human beings connected.
Malcolm, can I shake your hands too? Because all these young people were. And he said, what for? And I didn't know first what to say. What for? I said, because what you're doing for your people. And he said, and what am I doing for my people? You're giving directions.
Get off the welfare. Right. Get out of that compensation line.
Right.
Be a man.
Right.
Earn what you need for your own family.
Right.
Then your family respects you.
Right.
They are proud to say, that's my father.
That's right.
She's proud to say, that's my husband.
Yeah.
Father means you're taking care of those children.
Right.
Just because you made them, that don't mean you're a father. Anybody can make a baby.
Right.
But anybody can take care of.
Right.
Anybody can go and get a woman.
Yeah.
But anybody can take care of a woman.
Right.
So husband means you are taking care of your wife.
Right.
Father means you are taking care of your children.
Right.
You are accepting the responsibilities of manhood.
And then he just changed and said, he came out of that, the center of that, you know, where everybody was there, came out and he stuck his hands out, so I ran and grabbed it. I couldn't believe that I was shaking Malcolm X's hand.
Very different paths, very different realities in America, and yet they developed a revolutionary friendship.
People told us, Malcolm's not going to go to your house. He doesn't know you, and it's dangerous for him right now. What made you think that he might come? Well, I said, well, it's true, I'm not sure. I wrote to him, I did not hear from him, but his office called and said they would do whatever they could that he might come. And he did. And our place was jam-packed. We lived in a housing project in Harlem. And I wasn't sure he was going to come, so I didn't want to advertise it too much and have people come, and then they'll wonder what happened and he didn't come. But a lot of people showed. Our house was jam-packed, and Malcolm did come, and we were all so surprised and just so tickled. People were really more amazed that he would take the chance of coming to a strange home of people he didn't even know anything about, when there were so many rumors that something might happen to Malcolm. And when he did come, of course the people were just so excited. Everybody wanted to shake his hand. They didn't know if he would shake the hands of white people or what. But Malcolm just surprised everyone. He was so warm to everyone, no matter what color. And people were just astounded that Malcolm has that wonderful way. He's so down to earth.
It makes a lot of sense to me, because when you look at the Japanese community coming out of World War II, there weren't a lot of people talking that way, you know? They were really inspired. The Asian American movement was inspired by the civil rights movement.
People barely know about Asian American activism. It's becoming more visible to the mainstream in the most recent period. We have a very long and rich history of protest and active organizing against racism and for transformative change for liberatory communities. For example, in Hawaii in 1920, to protest the work conditions on the sugarcane plantations in Hawaii, the Japanese and Filipino sugarcane workers united and had a huge industry-wide strike.
Mobilization was largely ethnic-specific, but you know, notably that changed in the 1960s, of course, with the civil rights movement, free speech movement, anti-Vietnam War movement, and the emergence of the Asian American movement itself, you know, that brought together Americans of various Asian ancestries. So the term Asian American itself is a political coinage that reflects this emphasis on unity. The Asian American movements also work in multiracial and transnational solidarity with other groups, both in the United States, but also with people in the developing world who are fighting against racism, neo-imperialism, racialized labor exploitation, structural inequities such as access to housing, food, and healthcare that bound them together. In the 1980s, you know, when Southeast Asian refugees first arrived in the United States from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, Southeast Asian parents and Latinx parents work together to ensure bilingual support for their children and equitable access to the curriculum for their children. You've got Grace Lee Box, who was a dedicated advocate and long-term advocate for African-American communities.
Asian-American and activism seems like oxymorons, which they are not. Studying Asian-American activism, it changes, it transforms us, I think, to think of ourselves as connected to a history of resistance and protest. It changes how we think change happens in society. It is through hard work, it is through education, but it isn't only through that.
I really want to encourage the younger generation of Asian Americans, you know, to really delve into these histories, to learn not just about the particularities of the challenges facing our communities, but also these kind of long and intertwined histories of solidarity, of coalitional politics, right? It is critically important for all of us to be at the table speaking about this. And for allies, you know, to come together and support communities that may not have the resources, that may not have the platform.
Really not just struggle for the low-hanging fruit, not just struggle for the things that are actionable items that, that we can do kind of in the immediate, because so often those turn into transactional reforms, when what we really need is long-haul social movement building. There's something that happens when we dream big and when we have a radical imagination. We begin to see the world that we actually want. People are talking about a lot, right, which is self-care. And I'd like to think about it as collective care. And this is a lesson that I've really learned from Yuri Kochiyama. And she's, of course, best known for having worked with Malcolm X. She always cared about the political prisoners. She would tell people it's their birthdays, you need to send them a card. She always asked people how they were. They think it's really important that we take time to take care of ourselves, whatever that means. And I think to be reflective and to slow down.
And they said, oh, no one from our community is speaking this way. Oh, we're allowed to speak that way? I don't think they knew they were allowed to speak that way. So she was really inspired by what he had to say. And, you know, she was from California, and she didn't return to California after World War II because I think she was a little bitter about being on the West Coast. I think most people were. And so she went to the East Coast, and over there you were getting discussions that weren't happening on the West Coast.
Harlem was the place to go. I would pick up, you know, leaflets on the street, and gee, it would be so interesting that I wanted to know more, and I'd pick up every time I'd see a leaflet, and it'll say when the next event or what. All my kids started in real young, and they used kids for a lot of things, where kids were getting hit by cars. They asked all the mothers to bring their toddlers and or babies and put them in the middle of the street and don't let any cars pass. And we're going to stay there until the government will give traffic lights throughout Harlem.
I don't advocate any kind of hate. No, I think that the guilt complex of the American white man is so profound until when you begin to analyze the real condition of the black man in America, instead of the American white man eliminating the causes that create that condition, he tries to cover it up by accusing his accusers of teaching hate, but actually they're just exposing him for being responsible for what exists. I don't in any way encourage black people to go out and initiate acts of aggression indiscriminately against whites. But I do believe that the black man in the United States and any human being anywhere is well within his right to do whatever is necessary by any means necessary to protect his life and property, especially in a country where the federal government itself has proven that it is either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of those human beings.
Malcolm X seemed so radical, and if you remember way back then, all the media just crucified him. They tried to smash him, make him seem like such a hate monger, when all he was doing, he was just being very pro-black and fighting for his own people.
Cotton pickings don't move me. No. But when it comes to teaching the black people something about great black men who stood their ground, who were scientists, who were civilizers, who were fathers of culture and civilization, the white man has shrewdly written that role out of the textbook. And today, the effect that it has on you and me, we don't think we can stand on our own two feet.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, A Revolutionary Friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
You know, you had communities that were far more integrated and were much older, you know, in New York City, having to live right next to each other. And so those conversations were older and were happening. And I think she was really inspired by that and hearing people speaking out and saying, hey, we should speak out against injustices, because definitely within the Japanese American community, historically, you don't speak out against the government. You know, a lot of Japanese Americans thought that she wasn't patriotic, and they thought that she was being very anti-Japanese American. So, you know, it was more than just revolutionary for her as an American to speak out against him. It was like revolutionary within the community too, and she's still controversial within the community.
In the African American community, Malcolm X is still controversial as well, because he introduced the mass of African Americans to the religious concept of Islam. You know, he was a Muslim, and he made white people uncomfortable talking about standing up for your human rights and the whole repudiating King's statement on nonviolence, saying, you hit me, well, you know, you're going to have a problem there, bro. And because that made white people uncomfortable, it made black people uncomfortable too. So to this day, Malcolm X is still fairly controversial in the black community.
You know, the American press did not have a very good, I mean, they would not show any kind of a good image of Malcolm. But the Japanese knew that black people admired him and wondered also, however, why America would be afraid of one lone black man.
They didn't need civil rights legislation to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take a civil war to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take Supreme Court decisions to solve any other minority problem or legislation. It takes none of that other kind of that action to solve the minority problems of these other people. The only real minority in America is the Afro-American. Now, when white people, who are oppressed and poor, supposedly, but the poorest white person can go where the richest black person can't go. It isn't only poverty of in money that we're talking about. Poverty in spirit, poverty in freedom, poverty in equality, poverty in human dignity. This is the kind of poverty we're suffering from. So that the richest Negro in this country is still poor. When it comes to freedom, he's broke. When it comes to human dignity, he's broke.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, A Revolutionary Friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
I got that third world militant, still think it's relevant, even even if them kids caught the shirts and start wearing them. Humbled in the presence of the veterans, and not the ones who picked up their guns, but picked up their brethren and sisterin. History in the making, I was witnessing, listening. Seen this old Japanese lady with a sticker on her rocket said, "Free Mumia," and this was before the Trustafarians were saying it. Taking it for granted that we talk about the 60s and never get to talk to anybody who done lived and still exists. Better yet, she still resists speaking to a myriad of young, dumb, and ignorant kids. I was one of them, stuck around lingering. Said that it's a privilege to meet you in person, and she took my hand, said it's good to meet you too. And when I'm out of school, asked me what I'm gonna do. I had to think about it, but truth is I knew that it was something for the youth. Truly, I'd probably be a teacher if the music didn't make enough to make me want to gamble on its sustenance. And that's why I'm writing this, to tell y'all, from a scholar, when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my Kasamas, when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor, cause when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Comma, serve the people proper, when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
And I had stated in a newspaper article about an effort to take my life back in January, and at that time the Muslims denied it.
Why are they threatening your life?
Well, primarily because they're afraid that I will tell the real reason that they've been, that I'm out of the Black Muslim movement, which I never told. I kept to myself. But the real reason is that Elijah Muhammad, the head of the movement, is the father of 8 children by 6 different teenage girls. 6 different teenage girls who were his private personal secretary. The one who first made me aware of this was Wallace Muhammad, Mr. Muhammad's son. And it was their fear that if I remained in the Black Muslim movement, and this came into the knowledge of his followers, that they would leave him and follow me. A plan immediately was set in motion to take me down, put me out, and the statement that I made about Kennedy was used as a pretext to take me down.
Did you get out of the... What you take to protect yourself from this threat?
I take no steps. I have a rifle. If anybody comes to my house without a good reason, I intend to try and use it, and that's all.
Everyone knew, though, that Malcolm's life was in danger.
What brought me to her is that photograph in Life magazine. She is cradling the head of Malcolm X right after he's assassinated. She witnessed his assassination.
Yeah, she was attending his talks, you know, regularly there in Harlem, and she was sitting right near the front. She had her son with her, and she witnessed, and she ran up to be with her friend.
I seen a picture up in Life magazine. You were sitting in front seat from Malcolm's last speech. Saw the first man with the shotgun. Two more came to get the job done. Now who would have thought that it'd be you holding him? I wonder what you felt when his eyes were going dim. And if he never died, would he know that he or would he been the leader that we always seem to miss? Now there's no turning back, whatever happens, and I miss. You remind me that it's more than just a martyr and a myth. You could have said it quits many times ever since. And you find there will always be a reason for the fist. The last one to hold him could have been somebody else. You still be remembered for the people that you helped. They said to keep trying, but never losing hope. Revolutionaries die, but the revolution don't. And it won't, and I put that on my mama. Cause when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
Who did one of these, what do you call it? You know, when you try to get attention?
Diversion.
What?
A diversion.
Yes, good thing. 2 people did a diversion. One guy got up and said, "Get your hands out of my pocket." And they started fighting, the two. And when that fighting was going on, everybody was looking at them. They were just almost across from where we were sitting. But while we're all watching these two, the 3 people up front got up with shotguns and they hit Malcolm quite a few times. And I mean, you could imagine, here is Malcolm, one of the most beloved people by the people that were there for him,
in Harlem and seeing him get shot and die. And then, of course, what happened was the cops were smart. They didn't, usually they're everywhere, but they didn't come into that hall that day. They wanted something to happen, and it did. Malcolm was killed. And it was such a big news that I know when I left the Audubon Hall, and I had to go to work at a restaurant, I didn't know whether I should go or not. But even the subways, they had a message through the subway system that Malcolm X was shot. I just want to read something about that someone wrote, which I thought was beautiful, about Malcolm. Malcolm was not just a black man. He was the black experience. He went through everything that the poorest blacks had gone through. He was baptized into blackness and repudiated his slave name and took on the X, the unknown, the potential of what could be, the reality of what he became. So I'm glad to ask the one question on Malcolm. Thank you.
So Malcolm and Yuri, they were born on the same day, May 19th. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. It's like their fates were kind of intertwined from the beginning.
May 19th. I'm so glad that they had the same birthday. I believe they have much more intelligent conversations than, what sign are you? Right?
I would love to hear that conversation anyways, because you know they would somehow make it really interesting.
They would. They would make it extremely interesting. They had a very unique friendship.
When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Koshiyama.
You know, you spoke earlier about how controversial Yuri was and is in the Japanese-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in the African-American community, Malcolm X is still controversial as well, because he introduced the mass of African-Americans to the religious concept of Islam. You know, he was a Muslim. And he made white people uncomfortable talking about standing up for your human rights and the whole repudiating King's statement on nonviolence, saying, you hit me, well, you know, you're going to have a problem there, bro. And because that made white people uncomfortable, it made black people uncomfortable too. So to this day, Malcolm X is still fairly controversial in the black community. But Yuri, what brought me to her is that photograph in Life magazine. She is cradling the head of Malcolm X right after he's assassinated. She witnessed his assassination.
And she was attending his talks, you know, regularly there in Harlem, and she was sitting right near the front. She had her son with her, and she witnessed, and she ran up to be with her friend and cradled his head. And, you know, and you hear these interviews with her where she then goes on to talk about how the first thing she did after she cradled his head was to cradle his baby.
I know. Can you imagine as a child seeing your father assassinated?
Yeah, you can't even imagine.
After she witnessed the assassination, she definitely became an active presence in the civil rights movement. She went to the South.
Oh, she went to the South? I don't know.
Yeah, she went to the South. All right, well, one thing I like about Yuri, among the things I like about Yuri is when you have one culture admire and adore someone from another culture, sometimes they take on the dress or the slang or the, you know, the way the person talks. But Yuri didn't do any of that. She was always herself.
That's something I really admire about her and why I've always looked up to her as an activist within my community, because she exemplifies what I think activism should look like. You know, she was always one to want to connect communities in order to address oppression, but she was also about staying in your lane as a way to say, this is how we address oppression. You can't go and think that everybody's struggle is equal. You need to acknowledge that the struggle, you know, between this group and that group, that the power imbalance is there often because the government sets it up to be that way. It's in a systemic thing. And so you have to address it, and that you have to always be able to stay in your lane in order to be the most powerful voice that you can be. And so, you know, it's like within the Asian American movement, as you were talking about, there were many people who were appropriative of the civil rights movement and of the Black struggle at the time. And she was just someone who always said, I want to amplify your voice. I want to help you with your struggle, and I will understand your struggle through my own. And but then also have the compassion that comes from my struggle, but realize that it's not the same, and that I'm allowed to see that your struggle is more, and that I can help you. We can speak with unified voices while still seeing the difference in our experience.
Asian Americans must be more vocal, visible, and take stands on crucial issues. Hopefully, Asians will side with the most dispossessed, oppressed, and marginalized, remembering our own history. We Asians need to reshape our image from the rather quiet, ambiguous, accommodating, uncomplaining, palatable people to a more resolute, sensitive advocate for human worth, human rights, and human dignity.
Yeah, but okay, there's a cultural inference. I agree with what you're saying. There's a cultural, and for African Americans, there's a cultural inference to show you how different Uri and Malcolm was in the African American community viewed by the majority culture. There's an inference that African Americans, people of color, are inferior. Whereas in your community, you're Japanese American, you're the model minority.
Oh yeah, we're number one. Or at least that's what...
You're one plus one, okay? You're what people aspire to be, and that creates some problems for your own community, right?
Oh, for sure. You know, there's a really great Japanese-American activist here in Portland named Scott... What is Scott's last name? Scott Nakamoto, former KBOO volunteer, and he always likes to talk about how Asian Americans are the fulcrum around of which oppression happens in this country for people of color, where Asian Americans are set up, right, as this model American or model minorities, especially Japanese Americans. We are the model minorities, and that, you know, constantly our quote-unquote success is there to oppress other people of color, right? Because people always say, hey, if Japanese people can make it, then everyone else can make it. But they don't want to talk about the fact that Japanese people are literally allowed to succeed.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Uri Kochiyama.
This is Nia Gray, your faith reporter, with From the Grassroots. April 1964, that's when Malcolm X split with the Nation of Islam, shortly after he traveled on a pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca, where he was exposed to mainstream Islam. And I quote, "But we were all participating in the same ritual, displaying a spirit of unity and brotherhood that my experiences in America had led me to believe never could exist between white and non-whites. But on this pilgrimage, what I have seen and experienced has forced me to rearrange much of my thought patterns previously held and to toss aside some of my previous conclusions." Malcolm X later said that seeing Muslims of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans, interacting as equals led him to see Islam as a means by which racial problems could be overcome. Quite different than the black separatist philosophy of the Nation of Islam and their teachings that white people are devils. Malcolm didn't just have an epiphany of how true faith is colorblind with a message of acceptance. He also spoke truth to power when he heard rumors of Elijah Muhammad's extramarital affairs and subsequent illegitimate children fathered by him. Malcolm understandably became disillusioned when the rumors were found to be true. And instead of repenting for his wrongdoings, Muhammad attempted to justify his behavior using scripture. All people of faith should look to Malcolm X, including Christians, as an example of speaking truth to power and leadership of the church when they break from the truth, to hold them accountable to the scripture and the example that Jesus has left for us. No, the Bible doesn't say don't lock up immigrant children, but the Bible doesn't have to get that specific when the overarching theme is love. When Jesus was asked, what is the most important commandment? He responded, love your God with your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Loving your neighbor as yourself is the antithesis of racism, bigotry, and discrimination. The way you treat other people is a direct reflection of the maturity of your relationship with God. Like John wrote in the Bible, if you say you're a Christian and you hate your brother, the truth isn't in you. Martin Luther King once said, he who passively accepts evil, as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetrate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it. And Malcolm X wasn't going to be complicit or turn a blind eye to his own folly. He wasn't afraid or too rigid in his beliefs to discard false understandings in light of reality and to remain dedicated to the truth. We should be just as bold and speak up when we see the hypocrisy in our modern churches, judging homosexuals while the male church members are addicted to pornography and pastors are molesting children. When the church aligns itself with ungodly political leaders while quietly appointing conservative judges, what do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? I suggest we don't leave churches, but we stay to change them from the inside out. Less than a year after his trip to Mecca, Malcolm X was assassinated. Malcolm X's life exemplifies a dedication to truth and justice, as well as a commitment to faith. This has been Nia Gray with your Faith Report.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
This week marks 56 years since civil rights activist Malcolm X was assassinated right here in New York City. For decades, there have been many questions around the circumstances of his death and whether the three men convicted of his murder were actually the people responsible. Well, at a news conference last Saturday, Malcolm X's daughter heard a letter for the very first time that they say is evidence that the NYPD and the FBI conspired to have their father assassinated.
White people don't realize how frustrated Negroes have become.
Malcolm X was a legendary orator, charismatic, controversial, revolutionary.
To lift the struggle for freedom of the Negro in this country from the level of civil rights to the level of human rights.
On February 21st, 1965, he was assassinated while giving a speech at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. Now, 56 years later, a letter given to Malcolm X's daughters could hold proof the NYPD and the FBI conspired to have him killed.
I am relieved that I am able to share this truth with the world today.
Reginald Wood reads the words of his cousin, former undercover cop Raymond Wood, who died in November. He wrote that letter in 2011 to be released upon his death.
It was my assignment to draw the two men into a felonious federal crime so that they could be arrested by the FBI.
Those men were members of Malcolm X's security detail and were arrested days before his assassination.
There was no security to prevent the gunmen from coming into the building.
Three members of the Nation of Islam were convicted of the murder.
Malcolm's death never sat right with me.
On the heels of the 2020 Netflix documentary, Who Killed Malcolm X?, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office began a preliminary review last February. After the letter's release, it says their review remains active and ongoing. As for the NYPD and the FBI, they say they have turned over all their relevant records to the DA and will cooperate.
here at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. For Harlem is where he worked and where he struggled and fought, his home of homes, where his heart was and where his people are. And it is therefore most fitting that we meet once again in Harlem to share these last moments with him. For Harlem has ever been gracious to those who have loved her, have fought for her, and have defended her honor even to the death. It is not in the memory of man that this beleaguered, unfortunate, but nonetheless proud community has found a braver, more gallant young champion than this Afro-American who lies before us, unconquered still. Many will ask what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain, and we will smile, and we will answer and say unto them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did he ever touch you? Did you have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. That was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is, a prince, our black shining prince who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so.
To be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
The last one to hold them could have been somebody else. You still be remembered for the people that you helped. They said to keep trying, but never losing hope. Revolutionaries die, but the revolution don't, and it won't. And I put that on my mama, cause when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my Kasamas. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Comma, serve the people proper. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
Yuri Kochiyama died June 1st, 2014. Malcolm X was assassinated February 21st, 1965. They were both born May 19th. Happy birthday, Malcolm. Happy birthday, Yuri. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News North.
Thank you.
Section Z.
Planning. Hi, I'm Dr. Demento, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Radio is hiring. We are currently accepting applications for the position of Membership Coordinator. The Membership Coordinator is responsible for planning and developing KBOO's fundraisers and on-air membership drives, data entry, working with major donors, direct mail campaigns, and community outreach. This position is 25 hours per week. For the full job description and instructions for applying, go to our website at kboo.fm/membership-hire or send your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org. Applications are due by midnight, Friday, May 19th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.